The publication of his criticism of communism in 1936 brought him much personal abuse and the loss of former friends on the left. Manes Sperber, a Polish-Jewish writer living in exile and working in Paris, a destination for numerous Jewish émigré, once Hitler's takeover of power had forced him out of Germany, had growing doubts about Soviet communism as early as 1931, following a visit to Moscow. But he shrank from knowledge that would cause me both political and emotional difficulties, and remained a party member, motivated primarily by the fight against fascism, until the absurdities of the Stalinist show trials forced him to make his exit in 1937. Arthur Kessler, also Jewish, a Budapest-born prolific author and journalist, joined the German Communist Party in 1931, but began to be disillusioned with Soviet reality after he had witnessed forced collectivization and famine in Ukraine. The break didn't, however, come abruptly or quickly. The Spanish Civil War shaped it. Like numerous other intellectuals on the left, he had gone to Spain to fight fascism, but seeing communist policy there dictated solely by the interests of the Soviet Union, and hearing of obviously faked charges in the show trials against loyal communists, he inwardly abandoned Stalinism while languishing in one of Franco's jails, for a while under a death sentence. Even then, for the sake of upholding anti-fascist unity, he kept silent about it for months, until he finally broke with communism in 1938. His brilliant novel, Darkness at Noon, 1940, was a bleak reconstruction of the psychological pressure inflicted on those accused of any perceived deviation from orthodoxy in order to produce the absurd confessions of former Soviet stalwarts in the Stalinist show trials. Kessler was directly confronting the crucial dilemma that faced many left-wing intellectuals in the 1930s. How to stay loyal to the only force capable of withstanding and defeating the menace of fascism, while recognizing that the Soviet Union had become a grotesque caricature of the deeply held ideals that had motivated them. For a sizable minority among intellectuals, the ideals of the left, let alone the levels of violence that had accompanied the Russian Revolution, the subsequent civil war and the Stalinist dictatorship, were anathema. These looked to the right for salvation from Europe's crisis. Some became direct advocates of fascism. What they had in common was belief in the need for spiritual renewal to overcome the descent into barbarism and nihilism of degenerate mankind. Fascism in the 1920s and 1930s, its full expression of inhumanity and the genocidal horror of the Second World War still lay in the future, offered them an alternative utopia, one that blended a largely mythical elevation of past cultural values with a vision of a modern, homogeneous, and united nation that incorporated those values. Fascism's appeal wasn't as such atavistic. The hopes, for instance, of Filippo Marinetti and the futurists, who glorified the revolutionary violence of the modern machine age and lauded Mussolini, lay not in a resort to the past, but in the vision of a utopian modern society. An expressionist poet like Gottfried Benn could be drawn to Nazism as a revolutionary force that would create a new modern aesthetics, though he was rapidly to become disillusioned. The influential modernist poet and critic Ezra Pound was born in the USA, but based in London before the First World War. Disgusted by what he saw as the responsibility of international capitalism for the war, and despising liberal democracy, he moved to Paris, then to Italy, where he lauded Mussolini and saw Italian fascism as the harbinger of a new civilization. In contrast to Benn and others, Pound never became disillusioned. At any rate, he never recanted his belief in fascism. Faith in the new man, in the renewal of true culture, national rebirth often resulted in mystical expression that defied intellectual rigor. For the French political writer and novelist Pierre Drieux La Rochelle, obsessed as he was with national and cultural decadence, fascism and the Nazi occupation of France amounted to the great revolution of the 20th century, a revolution of the soul. Another pro-fascist French writer, Robert Brasillach, saw fascism as the very poetry of the 20th century, the spirit of national comradeship. The belief in spiritual renewal through national rebirth accounts in good measure for fascism's appeal to intellectuals. As many as 250 Italian intellectuals signed the Manifesto of Fascist Intellectuals in 1925, praising fascism as the faith of all Italians who disdained the past and longed for renewal. The manifesto had been composed by Giovanni Gentile, a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of Rome. Gentile looked to Italian fascism to create an ethical state that would supersede the moral will of the individual and overcome the decadence of bourgeois liberalism. He spoke in the mid-1920s of the soul of the new Italy, which slowly but surely will prevail over the old. He was even ready to boast of fascist barbarity as the expression of the healthy energies which shatter false and baleful idols and restore the health of the nation within the power of a state conscious of its sovereign rights, which are its duties. More remarkable still was the commitment to the Nazi movement of Germany's leading philosopher Martin Heidegger. The philosophy of this highly complex and sophisticated thinker, whose international renown had been established through his Sein und Zeit, Being and Time, published in 1927, predisposed him towards ideals that he saw represented by the Nazi movement. Crucial was a belief in the spiritual decay of his age, in the erosion of what Heidegger called authentic being, and his accompanying belief in the special destiny of the German people to bring about cultural renewal. Despite his brilliant mind, much of this came close to romantic mysticism. He saw Germany as centrally located between the great pincer grip formed by Russia on the one hand and America on the other, which together produced the same desolate frenzy of unbounded technology and unlimited organization of the average human being. Europe's road to annihilation, he wrote in 1935, could only be blocked by the unfolding of new historically spiritual forces from the center. By this time, Heidegger had long since committed himself to Hitler's Nazi movement, joining the party on the 1st of May, 1933. 3 weeks later, he had delivered an encomium of praise to the new regime in his address as a newly appointed rector of Freiburg University. He had glorified Hitler, speaking of him as a German reality, present and future, and its law, and had brought about the dismissal from the university of non-Aryan colleagues, including his former teacher and mentor, Edmund Husserl. Belief in the need for cultural or spiritual revolution went hand in hand with the fundamental rejection of liberal democracy. Both tendencies were particularly strong in Germany, though they were far from confined to that country. The German cultural historian Arthur Müller van den Broek blamed the whole political misery of Germany on political parties. His book, Das Dritte Reich, The Third Reich, published in 1923, offered a chiliastic vision of German perfection that had to be striven after, even though it could never be fulfilled. Brook didn't live to see his slogan adopted by the Nazi state, and, like other German neo-conservative radicals who advocated a conservative revolution, he might well have been disillusioned by experience of the reality of Hitler's regime. Another neoconservative, Edgar Jung, who had foreseen the construction of an organic German nation as the way to national resurgence and spiritual renewal, swiftly became disenchanted with the reality of Nazi rule, leading to his murder by Hitler's henchmen during the infamous Night of the Long Knives in June 1934. The German theorist of constitutional law, Carl Schmitt, proved more easily capable of adjusting to the realities of the new order in Germany. Schmitt, who had already gained prominence during the 1920s, rejected parliamentary institutions as the true expression of democracy. He argued for a strong sovereign state and a leader who represented the unity of the rulers and the ruled and was capable of exercising decisive power, if need be, freed from any legal restraints in order to serve the public interest. Law, in this sense, didn't bind rulers and ruled. Rather, it derived from the decisionism of the sovereign power whose responsibility it was to preserve order. Schmitt, who joined the Nazi Party in May 1933, later helped to legitimate the notion of the leader state. After Hitler had ordered the murder of his stormtrooper leadership in the Night of the Long Knives, it was no aberration that Schmitt published an article entitled "The Führer Protects the Law." The complexity and variety of intellectual life in interwar Europe can't, of course, simply be straitjacketed into the polarized opposites of left and right, of communism and fascism. Some intellectual trends were, in fact, as good as completely detached from politics. Logical positivism, the branch of philosophy particularly associated with Ludwig Wittgenstein, which argued that only propositions that could be empirically verified had any meaning at all, provides an example. Nor was economic and political thought inevitably drawn to the extremes. After all, among the most important intellectuals of the era was a British liberal, John Maynard Keynes, who loathed both communism and fascism. As Europe looked increasingly to models of society based on either Marxist state socialism or fascist authoritarianism, Keynes gave capitalist liberal democracy a lifeline by offering a way to a reformed capitalism in a reformed democracy. The most brilliant economist of his day, Keynes's work would make an indispensable contribution to the shaping of economic policy after the Second World War. His General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, published in 1936, rejected classical economics orthodoxy, which looked to sound finance, balanced budgets, and to the market to create its own equilibrium. Instead, Keynes provided the theoretical basis for government intervention through increased state expenditure to stimulate the market, create full employment, and thus provide the demand that would underpin economic growth. But Keynes, too, was driven by the sense of comprehensive crisis. Even if his upper-class English background and the relative solidity of British political structures meant that he sought solutions through economic policy within the framework of liberal democracy. Probably only in Britain, where the upper class continued to enjoy not just social status, but also almost unique levels of political stability, was the sort of bizarre judgment articulated by the novelist Evelyn Waugh possible. Waugh, a social snob, political reactionary, and ardent convert to Tridentine Catholicism, who was entranced by the English aristocracy and contemptuous of the rest of society, was dismissive of politics altogether, absurdly stating that chances of happiness were not much affected by the political and economic conditions in which people lived, and that no form of government was better than any other. Such eccentric views were remote from the preoccupation with crisis of most European intellectuals. The later 1930s brought mounting despair for those on the left. Many who went to Spain to join the fight against fascism returned, disillusioned. Then came the profound dismay at the betrayal of Czechoslovakia in 1938. Franco's final victory the following year and the Hitler-Stalin Pact, establishing friendship between the regime that they saw as the epitome of political evil and the country which so many had admired, were further extremely bitter pills to swallow. Meanwhile, the pluralism and openness on which intellectual life depends had been crushed in Germany, Italy, the Soviet Union, and much of the rest of Europe. Soon afterwards, normal intellectual life in Europe practically went into hibernation for the 6 long years of the war. Many of the most powerful anti-fascist intellectual voices were now those of German exiles. Among them were members of the influential Frankfurt School, relocated to New York, of eminent Marxist, though not Leninist, philosophers and social scientists, led by Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno, and writers of different political persuasion. These included Thomas Mann, his brother Heinrich, Alfred Döblin, Erich Maria Remarque, Leon Furtwängler, and Anna Zegers. As Hitler's empire engulfed nearly all the European continent, Stefan Zweig, exiled in Brazil, despaired of Europe, its culture, and the future of mankind itself. In February 1942, he and his wife took an overdose of sleeping tablets, held hands, and waited for death to come. As vitality started to return to Europe's intellectual life after 1945, both pessimism and optimism about the future were evident. The very depths to which civilization had sunk evoked, especially within the Christian revival that was much influenced by the theology of Karl Barth, a sense of hope for the future if society could return to the values and beliefs of Christianity. There was also renewed hope, though it really gathered pace only in the 1950s, in liberal democracy, which had eventually triumphed over the Nazi menace. Raymond Aron, the distinguished French political philosopher and ardent anti-Marxist, thought that we can close the age of hyperbolic wars without again falling beneath the yoke. The lessons of the two wars had been learned. The unleashing of violence settles nothing. The West's mission of liberty, he thought, had good chances of success. For yet others, optimism rested precisely in the opposite direction, in their renewed hopes for the ultimate victory of communism. The Soviet Union had been victorious over Nazism. Communists had played a disproportionate role in resistance movements that had courageously fought Nazi occupation. However, in Western Europe, belief in the Soviet Union was dwindling. As the wartime alliance with the USSR dissolved into the early Cold War, as Eastern Europe fell under the Soviet yoke, and as the horrors of Stalinism became more widely recognized, hope in the Soviet model of communism gave way to a new climate of hostility. Probably no literary works were more important in the immediate post-war era in shaping the stance towards the Soviet Union in the emerging Cold War than the two dystopian novels of George Orwell, Animal Farm and 1984. Orwell had been profoundly alienated by what he had seen in Spain during the Civil War of Stalinist intolerance of any deviation from the rigid party line. His anti-communism had been intensified by the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939. And when Stalin became Britain's ally after the German invasion in 1941, Orwell was appalled that this disgusting murderer is temporarily on our side, and so the purges, etc., are suddenly forgotten. Because of the wartime alliance with the USSR, publishers rejected his bitter satire of the emergence of Stalin's dictatorship, Animal Farm, on its completion in 1944. It finally appeared to great acclaim the following year, after the war in Europe had ended, both influencing and reflecting the new atmosphere of the Cold War. Even more influential was Orwell's frightening futuristic vision of what such a dictatorship would mean for individual freedom and political tolerance in his novel 1984. The title was an inversion of the date of completion, 1948, which was published in 1949 at a time when Eastern Europe had fallen under the grip of Soviet domination. A striking transition in the post-war intellectual climate was a new way in which the emerging criticism of Soviet communism was linked to structural analysis of Nazism. The two systems were seen as separate manifestations of essentially the same phenomenon, and the evils of the dead Nazi regime were transposed to the perceived live threat from the Soviet Union. The concept of totalitarianism, though in existence since the 1920s, was now deployed in changed and devastating fashion to bracket together the gross inhumanity of both regimes. By the mid-1950s, in the climate of the Cold War, the publications of the American political scientist of German origin, Karl Joachim Friedrich, would become central to this shift in usage. But already before then, the crucial work, highly influential throughout the Western world, was that of Hannah Arendt, a German Jewish exile to the USA, ironically a former lover of Hitler's philosopher king Martin Heidegger, meanwhile a distinguished political theorist herself. By 1949, she was completing her outstanding analysis, The Origins of Totalitarianism, which appeared 2 years later. The book was actually in the main an explanation of the rise to power of Nazism and focused in its first two sections on anti-Semitism and imperialism, themes with little relevance to the nature of Soviet power. The damning comparison with the Soviet Union came in the third part, totalitarianism, much of which appeared only in a later, much revised edition. This comparative section painted the bleakest picture of a radical evil, an entirely new political phenomenon whose essence is total terror, which destroys all basis of law, breaks down all standards that we know, and produces a system resting on factories of annihilation, in which all men have become equally superfluous. It was a searing assessment of the collapse of civilization. In the eyes of many intellectuals, the path that Europe had taken since the Enlightenment of the 18th century towards a civilized society based on principles of rationality and progress lay in ruins. The very foundations of modern society itself had been undermined. The era of the Enlightenment, Horkheimer and Adorno, had already concluded in 1944, had perversely culminated in the self-destruction of reason. But the critique of Horkheimer and Adorno wasn't confined to Nazism and Stalinism. It extended to capitalist modern mass culture. And soon, this culture industry, as they called it, would come to envelop the whole of Western Europe. On with the show, The Business of Popular Entertainment. Few among Europe's mainly poorly educated masses were concerned with the tortured attempts of intellectuals to understand the crisis they were living through, and religion was losing its grip slowly but surely. The more literate and educated the population, the higher the level of urbanization. The more advanced the industrial economy, the more the Catholic and Protestant churches had to struggle to hold on to people's adherence. They had to compete not just with philosophies that rejected Christianity and offered alternative secular religions, but with the myriad everyday distractions of modern life in towns and cities, though less so in the countryside. The churches might be emptying, but bars, football grounds, dance halls and cinemas were bursting at the seams. Amid the hecatombs of the two wars, separated by the misery of the Depression, people still looked for what made life worth living. They wanted fun. However humdrum most people's lives were, they were shaped not only by economics or the moral strictures of the churches, but by what made their existence more enjoyable. Flashes of colour in the grey, diversions from the dreariness, relief from the unpalatable. What people overwhelmingly wanted was entertainment, not priestly sermons, intellectual ruminations, or the edification of high culture. The spread of mass entertainment had already made enormous headway during the 1920s, but it wasn't yet the big business it was soon to become. Technological improvements were chiefly behind its stratospheric takeoff during the following decade, even amid the deep pall of economic gloom. Where entertainment had once been dependent on live performance, which could reach at best only a few hundred people on each occasion, the mass production of affordable radios and gramophones, often combined in the radiogram, meant that millions at precisely the same moment across an entire country and from the privacy of their own front rooms could listen to their favourite entertainers. Most of the impulses and innovations came from the United States. America represented all that was new, vibrant, and exciting for millions, especially young people in Western Europe. Popular music and film were the most dynamic forces. Britain, sharing the same language and with strong cultural ties to the USA, was more open than anywhere else to American influence, though barriers were erected in the 1930s to prevent British musicians being put out of work by imported American talent. Young people rushed to embrace it. The establishment was less enthusiastic. The founding Director General of the BBC, the austere and puritanical Sir John Reith, tried to stop what he saw as a cultural pollution of British radio through American influence. But his Canute-like efforts were doomed to failure. A burgeoning consumerism meant an insatiable demand for what the new cultural media had to offer, a demand avidly promoted by the rapidly growing entertainment business and the armies of those who made money from it. Show business entrepreneurs, publishers of songs, artists' agents, record producers, and many others. The unstoppable advance of popular music went hand in hand with that of radio, which made overnight stars of its leading performers. The phonograph had been invented by Thomas Edison, along with the microphone, as long ago as the 1870s. But even in the 1920s, sound recording remained fairly primitive. Hardly any of the popular songs of that era or preceding decades lasted to be heard by succeeding generations. That was soon to change. A decade or so later, microphones and recording techniques had improved massively. With better amplification, singers no longer needed powerful voices. They could hug the microphone instead of having to project their voice into it from some distance, and produced a far better sound than only a few years earlier. A new breed of crooners who could ooze out schmaltzy lyrics in more intimate fashion emerged to gain huge popularity. Bing Crosby was the first of the crooning superstars, whose massive popularity quickly crossed the Atlantic from the USA in the 1930s. Frank Sinatra did the same a few years later. Their records sold not in thousands, but in millions. Over 50 million records of Crosby's syrupy White Christmas, composed by Irving Berlin, have been sold since he first performed it in 1941. Even decades later, the song is hard to avoid in the piped music of department stores and supermarkets as Christmas approaches. European crooners also attained enormous popularity. This was often largely restricted to their own country, but some, like the British crooner Al Boley, actually born in Mozambique, whose The Very Thought of You was a big hit, had a level of success in the USA. European female singers too became household names in their own countries and sometimes beyond. Edith Piaf, the Little Sparrow, started out on her road to stardom in the mid-1930s, becoming within a few years France's most popular entertainer, and in later years, an international celebrity. In England, Gracie Fields, a Lancashire mill girl whose singing and acting had already propelled her to national fame in the 1920s, reached the height of her popularity in the Depression era with a repertoire of comedy and sentimental songs. The war and radio entertainment for the troops produced its own female stars. Vera Lynn, already well known through radio and records by the later 1930s, as a singer with some of the best-known British dance bands, was soon labelled the Force's sweetheart. There was hardly a British soldier who didn't know her big hit, perfectly attuned to the times, We'll Meet Again. Lala Anderson's Lily Marlene, though not liked by Nazi officialdom, became a favourite in the Wehrmacht and, remarkably, crossed the lines to become a hit also with Allied troops in its English version, sung by Marlene Dietrich. The leading popular singers of the 1930s and 1940s were products of the transformation and commercialization of the music itself. The early small hot jazz and blues bands of black musicians, whose musical roots lay in African-American slave and country music, were by the later 1920s being supplanted by white-dominated big bands. Each was named after its leader, paraded its star vocalist, and featured a smoother, more orchestrated sound and more sentimental appeal, tailored to radio's broader audiences. The new sound of the big bands had also begun in America, with the success of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra in the 1920s, giving Crosby his first major singing opportunity. There had, it's true, been some major big bands led by black musicians, such as Fletcher Henderson, but black musicians still faced discrimination in the commercial music market. Some of the top jazz players, such as the great trumpeter Louis Armstrong, who had come to fame with his Hot Five and Hot Seven bands in the 1920s, acclimatized to the changing trend and became stars in the emerging big bands before going on to lead their own. In the 1930s, where his success in his own country, though notable, was still limited through racial prejudice that kept black performers out of the most lucrative contracts, Armstrong's greatest popular acclaim was achieved in Europe. When his band toured Europe in 1932, he found the most wildly enthusiastic acceptance that any American performer had ever experienced. Duke Ellington, the most complex and innovative of all the early kings of jazz, experienced much the same when his band opened at the London Palladium in 1933. The applause was so terrifying, it was applause beyond applause, as he put it. 6 years later, his second European tour reached a rapturous climax in Stockholm in April 1939, with huge celebrations from his Swedish fans for his 40th birthday. Even Armstrong and Ellington were losing ground, however, to the new trends of popular music, in which swing became the new vogue. The chief exponent and beneficiary of the transition to swing was Benny Goodman, whose father had fled to America from anti-Semitic terror in Russia. Goodman, dubbed the King of Swing, was a superb clarinetist, whose band played an authentic version of jazz, profiting from the arrangements of Fletcher Henderson, who, like a number of other former leading black musicians, fell on hard times during the Depression. But Goodman had many imitators who were less innovatory and less gifted. They mainly converted swing to popular dance music, which was directed at exploiting the dance craze that crossed much of Europe during the 1930s. Dance halls, even more than during the 1920s, were the thriving hub of live popular entertainment for young people, though the frantic rhythms of the Charleston gave way to the more sedate foxtrot, quickstep, and waltz, before American troops brought the jitterbug, or jive, to Europe during the war. The most popular dance band leaders were major celebrities. Jack Hilton, the leader of Britain's most successful dance band, could command a weekly salary of £10,000 at a time when the pay for a week's grind in a factory was £2 to £3. In 1938, Hilton took his band, several of whose members were Jewish, to Berlin, where it played for a month to hugely enthusiastic dancers in a hall backed by an enormous swastika banner. Swing music in Nazi Germany, like jazz generally, was, however, decried as Negro music. During the war, young people deliberately aping British clothing styles and mannerisms even turned their devotion to swing into a form of youthful protest against the Nazi regime's regimentation, and were duly persecuted for their actions. But Hitler's Germany couldn't turn its back on the trend entirely, and, in fact, had its own official swing band, Charlie's Orchestra, which, despite the war, also had a radio following in Britain. Meanwhile, however, politically incorrect young SS officers in Paris continued to frequent jazz clubs. Even Nazism couldn't prevent the appeal of popular music. What the Nazi regime could do, however, was to eliminate popular entertainers who didn't fit its criteria for racial purity. Among them were the popular Jewish cabaret artist Fritz Grunbaum, who tried to flee from Austria immediately after the Anschluss in 1938, but was turned back at the Czech border. He was sent to Buchenwald, then Dachau, concentration camps, and died in Dachau in 1941. Fritz Lerner Bader, also Jewish, originally from Bohemia, a well-known lyricist who had worked on light musicals and operettas, with Franz Lehár, among others, was arrested in Vienna after the Anschluss, sent to Dachau, then Buchenwald, and finally deported in 1942 to Auschwitz. He was beaten to death in the attached industrial complex, Monowitz. And Rolf Erwin, born in Silesia, a Jewish songwriter, particularly known for composing the hit song Ich küsse Ihre Hand, Madame, I kiss your hand, Madame, made famous by the tenor Richard Tauber, fled Germany at the Nazi takeover in 1933. Erwin was captured during the German occupation of France and died in a French internment camp in 1943. In popular entertainment, as in other avenues of cultural life, the Nazis grotesquely impoverished Germany through their absurd as well as evil racial policies. The heyday of swing and of big band dance hall music was meanwhile passing. Dance halls obviously faced difficulties with so many young people away on military service. Bands were often forced to discontinue when their members were called up. Some carried on playing while in uniform. Others could no longer do so. Some were killed in action. Glenn Miller, the renowned leader of the 48-strong American band of the Allied Expeditionary Force, went missing over the English Channel when the plane carrying him disappeared in December 1944, en route to entertain American troops in France. His death symbolically marked the beginning of the end for the big bands. They entered a lengthy period of terminal decline, replaced by smaller bands that were cheaper to run and to employ. However, the commercialization of music was at best interrupted by war, but never broken. It would expand dramatically in the post-war years. Nowhere was the boom in the entertainment business more evident than in cinema. And in no sphere of entertainment was technological innovation more important than in film. A massive growth in cinema audiences had already taken place in the 1920s to watch silent films. But the breakthrough from silent film to sound movies saw the arrival of cinema's glory days. The first full-length feature film to include sound, actually no more than about 10 minutes in an otherwise silent movie, The Jazz Singer, a sentimental musical featuring Al Jolson in blackface makeup, had been an instant triumph in the USA in 1927. Within 2 years, most of Hollywood's films used sound. The rapid spread of talkies and increased production of feature films in color, though these were expensive to make and still a small proportion of total output, was accompanied by the huge expansion of the film industry and Hollywood's enormous cultural influence. A small number of vast corporations, MGM, Warner Brothers, Paramount, RKO Pictures, and 20th Century Fox, soon effectively divided up production, cinema ownership, and control of the market. By the mid-1940s, at their high point, Hollywood studios were turning out around 400 films a year, many of them comedies, musicals, westerns, and Walt Disney's cartoons. Much of the vast outpouring quickly crossed the Atlantic. By the mid-1930s, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck were as well known in Europe as in the United States, while Disney's first full-length cartoon film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, was a European as well as an American sensation following its release in 1937. Despite restrictions on the import of foreign films and an official aversion to what were viewed as the products of Jewish-dominated American cultural debasement, even Hitler liked Disney's cartoons. He was delighted when his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, gave him 18 Mickey Mouse films as a Christmas present in 1937. The once highly creative German film industry was by that time firmly in the grip of the Nazis. Among the products of the last faltering years of democracy before Hitler came to power had been the first talkie in German, Der Blaue Engel, also made in an English-language version, The Blue Angel, released in 1930, a film that had catapulted Marlene Dietrich to overnight international stardom. But soon, film producers, actors and directors were forced to emigrate, mainly to the USA. Thousands of non-Aryans who remained in Germany were dismissed from their jobs. The creative talent left was now put to work for the regime. The young and glamorous Leni Riefenstahl displayed her artistic gifts as a film director in propaganda films, notably Triumph des Willens, Triumph of the Will, 1935, and Olympia, 1938, which glorified Hitler and the regime. But as Germans flocked to the cinema in unprecedented numbers, around a billion a year, entertainment, not propaganda, was what audiences wanted. Even Goebbels, the Nazis' master propagandist, recognized this. Most of the films produced in Nazi Germany weren't, at least not explicitly, propaganda, but light entertainment. Romances and musicals like Wunschkonzert, Request Concert, 1941, or Die große Liebe, The Great Love, 1942, offered brief escapism from the grim reality of war. A sign of the importance Goebbels attached to escapist entertainment and to sustaining morale through the medium was the lavish funding he provided for the production of the color film Munchausen, a comedy fantasia, about the adventures of Baron von Munchausen, which in 1943 delighted and distracted German audiences as they reeled from the disaster at Stalingrad. In fascist Italy, too, the film industry suffered badly from regime control and censorship. As in Germany, the import of foreign films was restricted. Most Italian films were laced in some way with fascist propaganda and glorification of war, though many were light comedies and romance dramas. Little or nothing had stood the test of time. Two legacies for the film industry did, however, endure. In 1937, Mussolini opened Italy's first film studio, endowed with technically advanced production facilities, at Cinecittà, Cine City, outside Rome. 5 years earlier, the Venice Film Festival had been established in 1932, at which Mussolini Cups were awarded to the best Italian and best foreign film, nearly always German, each year. Creativity was also almost completely stifled in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, as Stalinist controls over all spheres of civilian life tightened immeasurably. Film production became heavily bureaucratized. Largely as a consequence of this and highly intrusive censorship, only half as many films were released each year as had been the case in the previous decade. The import of foreign films was halted, more or less completely, and the experimentation of the avant-garde cinema that had been prominent in the 1920s was replaced by the dreary uniformity of socialist realism, though, given the chance, Soviet film audiences were mainly attracted, as elsewhere, by comedies and light musicals, even if still heavily overlain with regime values. Outside the constraints of authoritarian regimes, film production in Europe had greater chances to flourish. Nowhere, however, could compete with the financial muscle, glamour, and ambition of Hollywood's giant corporations. This was a particular difficulty where language posed a barrier to penetration of the English-speaking market. In France, the birth country of cinema, and where film had been a prominent part of the artistic avant-garde during the 1920s, the advent of sound film not only turned the cinema from an intellectual art form into a major medium of mass entertainment, but caused problems in financing what was a heavily national market. The number of feature films produced grew sharply in the early 1930s, but a fragmented industry had trouble in funding production. Three-quarters of the films released in 1934 were foreign, leading to protests at the threat to French artistic production, expressions of disdain for the American invasion of French cinema, and demands for protection. French filmmakers struggled to compete. There was no chance of funding through big private corporations as in the USA. The state had to step in, as it did when a report commissioned under the Popular Front recommended state financing, which was implemented shortly before the fall of the Third Republic and continued under the Vichy regime. Finance alongside competition from the USA was also a problem for the British film industry. Attempts to boost British production and restrict foreign, that is, mainly American, imports simply led to a greater number of poor films. As elsewhere, the output of films was remarkable. In 1936 alone, nearly 200 films were released, a high point for the British film industry. Meanwhile, however, production companies were struggling to survive. By 1937, there were only 20 survivors among film production companies from over 600 that had existed over the previous decade. Even major producers with large budgets, such as the Hungarian émigré Alexander Korda, faced difficulties. Capital concentration was inevitable. By the later 1930s, a small number of big organizations, prominent among them the Rank organization, founded in 1937 by J. Arthur Rank, controlled much of the film production, cinema ownership, and distribution business in Britain. Rank soon owned the big cinema chains, the Gaumonts and Odeons, that by now occupied prominent sites in nearly every British town centre. These dream palaces were often resplendent Art Deco buildings with lavish interiors, frequently able to seat audiences of over 1,000. The majority of cinemas, however, were less than palaces, sometimes, in fact, downright seedy flea pits. These were the smaller independents, reliant on the major distributors for their films and only able to show them after they had appeared in the main cinemas. By 1939, Britain had some 5,000 cinemas, most of them thriving as the popularity of the cinema reached new heights. A visit to the cinema was far cheaper than the theatre. The owners of many provincial theatres had in fact seen the way the wind was blowing and converted them into more profitable cinemas. Even in the Depression, cinema seats had been affordable and offered a couple of hours of warmth and escapism out of the cold economic winds. Tickets at reduced prices in the 1930s enabled 80% of the unemployed to visit the cinema regularly. In all, 23 million people went to the pictures each week. Annual cinema ticket sales totaled by then close to a billion. Cinemas were the new temples of worship, film stars the new deities. European countries produced their own stars, though their appeal for the most part didn't cross national boundaries. One British actor who did establish an international reputation was the suave Robert Donat, who became well known for his roles in The Ghost Goes West, 1935, Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, also 1935, and Goodbye, Mr. Chips, 1939. Outside the English language sphere, it was even more difficult for stars to gain an international following. Although a household name in Germany, Hans Albers, found little recognition abroad. For that, it was necessary to go to America. Marlene Dietrich and Peter Lorre, of Austrian Jewish descent, left for the USA and became international stars. Emil Jannings and the Swedish actress Sara Leander, on the other hand, both turned their back on Hollywood and limited their celebrity largely to German-speaking countries. Given the near hegemonic influence of Hollywood, most international stars were inevitably American. As war descended on Europe, Clark Gable, in the biggest of contemporary Hollywood blockbusters, Gone with the Wind, 1939, scaled new heights of international popularity, soon to be followed by John Wayne, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Orson Welles, and others. The way was open for the continued American dominance of European popular culture, at least in the western half of the continent, once the war was over. Beyond the continuities and silent transformations in the socio-economic framework, the patterns of belief and institutional position of the Christian churches, the shifting intellectual currents and the pervasiveness of an increasingly US-dominated consumerist leisure industry lay the inescapable reality. Europe had nearly torn itself apart in the catastrophic, almost suicidal first half of the century. In a war-ravaged continent, the overwhelming question for the future was whether and how, out of the ruins, a new Europe capable of overcoming the suicidal tendencies of the old could begin to take shape. Ideas of a united Europe weren't new, but in the throes of Europe's catastrophe, they were resurfacing as a way of transcending the nationalism that had taken the continent close to complete destruction. Already, after the First World War, the Austrian aristocrat, Richard von Kudenhofer Kalagi, son of an Austro-Hungarian diplomat and a Japanese mother, had pleaded for a European customs and currency area stretching from Portugal to Poland to be constructed. He saw the overcoming of mutual hatred between the French and Germans as the essential basis of a new Europe. The French foreign minister, Aristide Briand, had a few years later, in 1929, floated the idea of a federation of European nations, resting upon political and economic cooperation. Briand's fellow countryman, Jean Monnet, later the inspiration of what would emerge as the first moves towards European integration, declared, while as part of the Free French government in waiting in Algiers in 1943, that there could be no peace in Europe until European states reconstituted themselves as part of a federation. Elsewhere, too, similar ideas were stirring, also in anti-Nazi circles in Germany. Even in the darkest days of the war, those who, with enormous courage, had joined the German resistance against Hitler and later often paid with their lives, were contemplating a better Europe, built on cooperation, not conflict, between nations. The theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he met Bishop George Bell of Chichester in Stockholm in 1942, spoke of the readiness of a German government, once Hitler had been removed, to give active support to an interlocking economy of European nations and the construction of a European army. In elaborating their ideas for a new Europe after the war, members of the Kreisau Circle resistance group were adamant in 1943 that the free and peaceful development of national culture can no longer be made consonant with the maintenance of an individual state's absolute sovereignty. Another memorandum, the same year, composed by the conservative Karl Goerdeler, spoke of the creation of a European federation to safeguard Europe against any further war, with a permanent European Economic Council, removal of customs borders and common political organizations, European ministries of economics and foreign affairs, and European armed forces. Such thoughts came to nothing at the time. Those who mooted them in Germany were soon silenced forever. But the idealism that they voiced, and even some of the concrete suggestions that they made, would, once the wreckage of the continent started to be cleared away, gain currency. Their aims seem prescient. A new Europe, on entirely different principles, could then begin to rise from the ashes of the old. Chapter 10. Out of the Ashes. Albert Camus, The Plague. On this earth there are pestilences and there are victims, and as far as possible, one must refuse to be on the side of the pestilence. Europe in 1945 was a continent living under the shadow of death and devastation. Here is a burial ground. Here is death, was how Warsaw, unrecognizable in its ruins, looked to the Polish writer Janina Broniewska, returning to the city immediately after its liberation. Arriving back in Germany after more than 12 years of enforced exile, Alfred Döblin, the celebrated author of Berlin Alexanderplatz, published in 1929, was shocked at seeing towns of which little more than the names exist. In continental Europe, railway networks, canals, bridges and roads have been wrecked by bombing or destroyed by retreating troops. In many areas, there's no gas, electricity, or water. Food, medicine, and, as 1945 drew on and winter approached, fuel for heating, were in desperately short supply. Agricultural production had been nearly halved. Malnutrition was widespread. Everywhere there was piercing hunger, accompanied by the diseases it fostered. Housing was an overwhelming problem. Where people had a home at all, it often had to be shared with others, frequently strangers. But homelessness, in the wake of the vast destruction, was on a catastrophic scale. In the western parts of the Soviet Union, ravaged by German occupiers, 25 million people were without shelter. In Germany, about 40% of pre-war housing had gone, some 10 million dwellings in all. Altogether, more than 50 million people were left without homes at the end of the war, desperate for food and shelter as they scratched around in the ruins of towns and cities. Many more millions were in other ways without homes, displaced persons, former forced labourers, refugees or prisoners of war. The Red Cross worked tirelessly to organize relief. The United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, UNRWA for short, had been established by the USA in 1943, 2 years before the actual founding of the United Nations organization. Backed by over 40 countries, with its headquarters in Washington, D.C., it provided humanitarian workers who did what they could, and that was a great deal, to provide for and, where possible, repatriate 6.5 million displaced persons, many of them traumatized by their experiences.